So then we were headed towards, this was all building up, this was 1972, September. So, in fact, my coming here this year, this is 30 years ago that I first came to India with Srila Prabhupada as his servant for the month of Kartik. It was 30 years ago this month that I was Prabhupada's servant and came to Kartik at Radha Damodar Temple with Srila Prabhupada. Which, you can understand why also Prabhupada encouraged and developed everything for everyone, all of his disciples around the world, to come to the holy places. Because until you come to India, until you come to these places, it's very difficult to understand Krishna consciousness. When you come here, so many things become very simple. Simple to understand. Everything we had heard and read, everything in Bhagavad Gita, it all just manifests right here when you come to Vrindavan. So it was very amazing when I first came here. It was just extraordinary. And when I think that I got to come here with Prabhupada for that month, I think it was just the most fortunate thing I had ever done or will ever do in this life. So we're building up to that. We have plenty of time. Is anyone getting tired yet?
No.
Okay. So then we went to Dallas, and Prabhupada again is just being so sweet, He showed me how to use the cooker there. I actually learned how to use the cooker and massage him at the same time in the same room in the kitchen in Dallas, in Prabhupada's kitchen there. There was like an apartment attached to the temple. So, put down the straw mat right on the kitchen floor. And I think Prabhupada appreciated also that he could see that I was could pick things up. So we set up the cooker, Prabhupada's famed cooker. Everyone understands what I'm talking about in the cooker, yes? Yes. So he showed me how to set the cooker up, cutting the vegetables, I remember. And Prabhupada had treated us all as individuals. And depending on who we were and what we were doing and what our services was, he gave sometimes personal instructions could vary from person to person. I remember when I was washing the rice to use in the cooker to put in the thing, and I washed it and I drained it out and I started to put water in again right at the kitchen sink, and he's sitting there now and he's in his gumsha just helping and watching me. So I started to put, he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Oh, I'm washing the rice three times." He said, "Why?" So I was told I was supposed to wash rice three times. No. He said, "That's all right." He said, "Put it in the cooker." So then I put it in the cooker. And he showed me how to make different kinds of chapati dough. He showed me how to, he said in the winter, like here in Vrindavan, in the winter, sometimes they'll make chapati dough with curd and whey. You just, get soured milk and you turn it. And then you put the flour in there, and he said it makes heartier chapati, for winter time. And then he showed me just dropping the dough in the water and letting it sit in water for an hour or so. And then you take it out and you knead all the, wheat gluten back in there, and it makes a very elastic type of dough. So he would show me little things, every little bit here, a little bit there. He knew I wasn't a great cook by any means. Someone once said to him in his room, "Prabhupada, Shruti Kirti is a very good cook." And Prabhupada laughed. He said, "Yes, yes." He said, "Why are you laughing?" Prabhupada said, "Yeah." He said, "He cooks nice American prasadam." And I found out what he meant when I came to India and I went to Vrindavan during Kartik and Jamuna was cooking for Prabhupada. Then I found out what prasadam could taste like. And then I realized I was a terrible cook. I had no idea. But I didn't, I didn't overcook or undercook, and I didn't burn things too much and didn't over, So I made nice American prasadam. And outside of India, I always cooked for Prabhupada, and Prabhupada took. He liked my chapatis very much. Certain things he liked that I made very much, and he would ask for them. He taught me how to make things sometimes at different times. So at this time, he showed me how to use the cooker and massage. Because the cooker would cook as you were doing the massage. So actually you were doing two things at once. And Prabhupada liked that. He would, in fact, it was here in Vrindavan at Krishna Balaram, Prabhupada would brag about that. Because especially when Prabhupada was in Vrindavan, he would talk about austerities in Krishna consciousness sometimes. How we minimize the activities of taking care of the bodily necessities. We spend a bare minimum amount of time. You know, not that we should spend all day cooking and doing laundry and washing and things. He said, but bare minimum. And he had in his quarters there, it was evening darshan, so there was about 50, 60 devotees and bridge bossies were sitting there. And Prabhupada was explaining how we, you know, want to concentrate our activities on chanting, reading, and preaching like that. And he said, just like my servant, he said, Shrutakirti, he says he does my whole lunch. He says 45 minutes. Whole lunch is finished. He said, in the cooker. And he says, isn't that right, Shrutakirti? I said, yes, Prabhupada. And then I said, not only that, Prabhupada, I said, but you're getting massaged while the lunch is being cooked. He said, yes. He said, cook lunch and massage, 45 minutes, boss. So he liked that. That was very nice. Of course, sometimes in India, they would be cooking from 8 o'clock in the morning until noon because we like to make a lot of nice things for Prabhupada. But the fact was, with the cooker, it would take 15 minutes to set up. And you turn on the flames, I would give Prabhupada massage, you'd come back to the room, and while Prabhupada was bathing and getting dressed, I would be rolling chapatis, making the chants, preparing everything, start to roll out two chapatis, and Prabhupada would bathe, he'd go into his room to dress, I had laid out his clothes, like I said, I was pujari, so I would lay out his kopin, lay out a dhoti, lay out his kurta. So Prabhupada would bathe, and then he would go into his bedroom. He would be on his bed, and he would dress. And then he would go sit down on his asana, and he would put on his tilak. I would have, Prabhupada traveled at that time. He had a nice compact mirror. It had a little ivory carving. You would open it up, and there was a mirror inside. And had a very small silver lota, about as big as a golf ball, with a little spoon and a little lid. So he'd take the lid off and just get the spoon and put couple drops on his finger, and he had that ball of tilak. And Prabhupada, we start out with a chunk, and Prabhupada would make it into a perfect ball, also about the size of a golf ball. And he would put on tilak, and then he would say Gayatri. So by the time Gayatri was finished, I'd be walking in with his lunch. So everything was timing. I'd be just on top of everything. So if something went wrong, then it was a big problem, but usually everything went very smoothly. So then I would go in to wherever it was and just put down the same thing. Prabhupada would eat by himself. Usually table was always facing the wall. Prabhupada would face the wall. Table would be against the wall. So then he would go in and sit down on a little straw mat like this or something. And lunchtime, and he would have the rice was in a container, which was inside the cooker. So Prabhupada would start, of course, with chapatis. So chapati would be on the plate. So he'd just start breaking up. So now as soon as I brought in the plate, then you'd run back to the kitchen and start to roll another chapati. So then I would bring Prabhupada one chapati at a time, fresh chapatis, and they would have to puff up. If they didn't puff up, no good. But somehow at that time, I was empowered because I was cooking for Prabhupada. So usually they always went good. And so each time you would come in, chapati would be like a balloon. You would go and slide it onto his plate and you offer obeisances. Prabhupada would push it down. He always liked to do that. And watch the steam come out and put a little vegetable and take. So then maybe take 3, 4, sometimes you might take 6 or 7, then you'd become in ecstasy every chapati. Then after prasadam, you'd have to tell him, Prabhupada ate 6 chapatis today. Because that we loved when the more Prabhupada ate, and then he was feeling very, very healthy. You know, that was a sign that Prabhupada was feeling robust. So that we liked that very much. The more Prabhupada ate, the more we liked. And then he would finish his chapatis and take the rice, cap off the rice, and nice steaming rice would be there. So then he would start mixing his rice with little dal, a little vegetable like that. And he would go on eating until, of course, he ate his sweets. I remember we had our very first big name pujari for the deities in New Dwarka. Her name was Shalavati. She was just in New Vrindavan recently. We saw her there. It's so nice to see her. But she was the first personality pujari, Shalavati. She made all the clothes for the Radha Damodar deities on the road show, as well as was their pujari. So. Anyway, I remember telling her this, how I would serve Prabhupada as chapatis one at a time. So, since she was pujari, head pujari in New Dwarka, she had an idea. So one day she came up to me, she said, "Oh, Shruta Kirti." She said, "I started to bring the deities one puri at a time." So she was serving in their lunch, you know, then we close everything and let Radha Rukmini Dwarka deities, she go in to tie their eating. But she decided that Prabhupada was getting lunch like this, so she should do it for Rukmini Dwarka deities. So she's going back and forth cooking puris and rushing them in. So she told me this. Immediately, was, you know, red light went off in my head. I said, "That didn't sound good, you know." I said, "Prabhupada." I said, "Shalavati told me she's bringing puris into the deities one at a time during lunch, just like I'd bring you chapatis." Prabhupada said, "This is nonsense," he said. He'd always say, "You Western disciples," he said, "always want to change." He said, "I give you a simple thing to do, and you change it." New Dwarka was headquarters for change. They were bringing in, I remember I brought, because I would make Prabhupada sandesh. He said, "You can keep sandesh for days if you make it right. You make it nice and dry, add sugar, it will keep for days. So even in traveling, if you don't have sweet, you can just take sandesh." He said, "You can give me sandesh each day." So he said, "My sandesh was first class." He said, "I had become expert." So, and that was, he liked sandesh and rasgulla very much. We know he liked lugdu. He said he liked lugdu. But sandesh and rasgulla was very common. Prabhupada would have every day. But in New Dwarka, sometimes I would bring them from the Mahaprasad, from the deity plates. So I brought this, they were making this one sweet. It was carob, puffed rice, powdered milk, peanut butter, all just rolled into these balls, you know. And I brought it to him and went to me, "What is this?" he said. I said, "Oh, this is... that's a sweet, Prabhupada, they're making here for the deities." He says, "Why are they making such nonsense?" he said. He said, "I've given you such nice..." He said, "I've given you rasgulla, sandesh, burfi, you know, like that, para." He said, "All these nice sweets." He said, "Why are they concocting things?" You say the same thing. "You Westerners always concocting." He said, "I give you something and you concoct." And we did all the time. Still do. So difficult just to follow. And see, this was, to Prabhupada, these were simple things, but they're very significant, because if you do one little thing, then who knows what else you're doing, right? On a big level, you know, on a high level, who knows what else is going on. In Juhu one day, on a morning walk, Prabhupada came down from his flat. This is still early, this is 1973. 75 maybe, he was living in the flat. So he came down his flat, and then he would go on his walk from there. So just like this, there was a crowd. Anyway, there were maybe 100 or so, 200 devotees. So Prabhupada came down, and I was walking beside him, and we were starting to walk, and others were starting to walk. Of course, everyone offered obeisances. There was one boy, young boy, 18, 19, 20-year-old boy, and he just stood, and he didn't take his eyes off Prabhupada, and he just stood with his hands folded.
as Prabhupada was walking. So Prabhupada just turned to me and he said, that is the beginning of his fall down. That's one thing. So this is how Maya is so tricky, you know. Maya enters very simply, we would think, oh well, he offered respect but he just wanted to watch Prabhupada. But Prabhupada saw it, this is the beginning of his fall down because he didn't offer obeisances and the spiritual master was in front of him. So Maya's like that. She makes everything seem no big deal. You can do that, you know. You can miss a few rounds, you can do this, you can do that. I'm still here, day after day, you see. All of a sudden, one day, you're far away. Far, far away. So Maya doesn't come in and bang you over the head. She just takes you a little bit at a time. That's what it says. And then one falls down to the material pool. And you reach a point and then you're gone. So Prabhupada would give little hints of how these things were going on. He had a Sanskrit editor, same thing. I would massage Prabhupada, of course, before lunch every day. And many times, Prabhupada, do we call it multitasking now, yeah? And Prabhupada always was multitasking, doing so many things. So he was getting massage, but he didn't just sit there and get massage. Often his secretary would come in and go over the mail. At that time, it was only called snail mail, right? Slow mail. So he would get 25 or so letters a day from his disciples. And very often he would answer the mail during massage. Secretary would come in, and the Sanskrit editor would come in, and he would have questions about the previous morning's transcription, the tape Srila Prabhupada had done. So this Sanskrit editor, I'm massaging Prabhupada, so he came in and out 4 or 5 times. So the first time he came in and offered obeisances to Prabhupada. So 5 minutes later, has another question. He came in and again, so this time he comes in and offers a little quicker his obeisances. So by the fourth time he came in, he would come in and go, pop his head down on the ground and come up like that, just like that. So Prabhupada looked at him and said, none of this hatchet. He said, you offer obeisances to your spiritual master. He also was gone soon thereafter. So we have to be very, very cautious in Krishna consciousness, you know, that things, we don't take anything for granted, especially before the deities and before the spiritual master. We have to be very cautious not to make offense. Because they would ask me, how do you remain around the pure devotee, the spiritual master for so long. And of course, Prabhupada was very merciful, but number one thing, of course, familiarity comes. And the spiritual master, Prabhupada treated us so nicely. With myself, he treated me very nicely. At nighttime, I would be massaging him, and sometimes he would just talk to me. He would tell me many, as you see in the Lilamrita now, some of the stories you see about Prabhupada's childhood, they're all things that he told me while I was massaging him at night. Sometimes he would lie there in bed and he would just start talking about his childhood. And I would just, that was my most favorite service, was massaging Prabhupada at night. Because then I was alone. No one ever went into Prabhupada's room when he was getting his evening massage. So, it was so nice for me because then it was just Prabhupada and myself, and I would massage his legs, massage his feet. Sometimes Prabhupada would be sitting up, chanting rounds, pulling down counter beads, and other times he would just be lying down, relaxing. And then sometimes he would talk and he would say things. And I would think, he's just talking to me because there's no one else here. So he's just talking to me, you know. And I would wonder how does this happen? You know, why? But he would do this with everyone, given the opportunity. It wasn't I was special. I don't think that I was special. I was fortunate, especially fortunate, but not special. But Prabhupada gave anyone that was in his presence the same opportunity. But it was very special for me because at that time of the night, Prabhupada would let everything go. And his meditation could turn very much just to Krishna, and just different things. Just like I say, you would think about it. He would go back into his childhood when he was a few years old, and he would speak about it just like he was there. And this is just the most incredible thing, this most wonderful thing. I finally realized he was saying it because he's given me the opportunity just to admire what I had said. It's what I see so much was just to have the opportunity to tell other devotees things that Srila Prabhupada had done. So in that way, I try to put it in perspective. But I just love those times so much. And sometimes I would be massaging Prabhupada's feet, and I would always be watching him. Sometimes Prabhupada would close his eyes. And when you massage Prabhupada, you always massaged him until he told you to stop. Once I did it a different way, I would stop. I was massaging during the day, and I did his head, and I did his back, and I started moving around and trying to make it a certain amount of time. He let it happen for a few days, and one day he grabbed me, my leg, and he said, "You massage until I tell you to stop, not until you tell you to stop." So from that time on, and I did it because sometimes you could massage for a very, very long time. And even at nighttime, it was the same policy. Was you could be massaging sometimes 11 o'clock at night, 11:30, 12 o'clock, and then have to get up early the next morning. There was never an excuse not to get up. That's one thing Prabhupada never minimized, the morning program. He always stressed the morning program. Stress going to Mangal Arati. Always. Whatever level one had attained to, Prabhupada would say, if you're so advanced, he said, you may be so advanced, he says, you don't have to go. He said, but then you go to set an example for the others. There was never an excuse not to go. And in his personal temple, like to say, Prabhupada and his entourage was like a little temple. But Prabhupada was the president, the temple commander, the treasurer, he was all of that, and we were just helping out. And he would call in sometimes. He said, where are the devotees? You know, where is entourage? Sometimes they'd be sleeping. Call them in here. And the first time it happened when I was with him was right in Radha Damodar, in his quarters at Radha Damodar Temple. And I was getting up early at that time. I've been a devotee for about a year and a half, and I was always up very early. In fact, in Dallas, the second day I was with him, one afternoon he called me into the room and he said, first he looked at me and he said, "Sruta Kirti," he said, "your name is too long." He said, "I'll call you Shruto from now on." I said, "Okay." He never called me Shruto again. it was just, Prabhupada was just very endearing. He was just more and more, he was just making me become so attached to him. So then he said to me, "Do you take a nap after lunch?" And I said, "Oh no, Prabhupada." That I had never taken a nap since being a devotee, you know. Kirtananda trained us up well, right? We barely slept at night, you know. But to speak of after lunchtime, the philosophy in New Vrindavan was we were living Bhagavad Gita. We didn't read Bhagavad Gita. Kirtananda had many little sayings, you know, it was work now, samadhi later, you know, living Bhagavad Gita. We couldn't read. You could read while you were eating your lunch. If you could manage to read and eat at the same time, you could do that. But yeah, we worked very hard. So Prabhupada said, "Do you take a nap after lunch?" I said, "Oh no, Prabhupada," I said. And he said, "I'm an old man." He said, "So when you're an old man," he said, "it's difficult to sleep at any one time." He said, "So sometimes I take a nap after lunch." And I just said, "Okay." And I'm thinking, he's telling me this, like explaining to me why he's taking a nap, and I can't understand why he has to explain anything to me, because whatever Prabhupada did was fine with me. That was my good fortune. I was always very simple, and anything Prabhupada did was wonderful and glorious, you know, so I had no problem. I never tried to figure out how many hours he was sleeping, or sometimes the devotees, how many hours did Prabhupada sleep? I said, I don't know. You know, I know I slept, you know, 6 hours or so if I could, but you know, and I mentioned his schedule, like I've mentioned, you know, he slept a couple hours at night. Maybe even he would translate and lie down for another half hour, and sometimes after lunch for an hour about. But I certainly didn't try to keep track of what he was doing. And they'll say, how many rounds did Prabhupada chant? I said, I don't know, Prabhupada was always chanting, you know. But he followed a very nice schedule. He actually, you know, whatever he was asking us to do, he was doing it. He did 3 gayatris every day. He rose early in the morning. Of course, he did his translating very early in the morning. And he took, you know, he took breakfast, he took lunch, and sometimes he took a little meal at night. And he always said, whatever you can digest, you should eat. We had all kinds of things, right? You know, and, you know, you're only supposed to have 2 chapatis. I remember breakfast time, you were supposed to have, what, 5 chickpeas for breakfast. We had all these things. I don't know, I guess it was just a Western, part of our Western mentality. We had everything. We had to be very fanatical, and we had to know exactly what to do. You know, there was this set formula other than the basic formula. But in Boston, I remember they would distribute the deity Mahaprasadam. That was lunch. So people were basically starving. That's why Maharaj was saying that my khichdi and breadsticks were so good. And when you're hungry, Prabhupada said, when you're hungry, any damn thing tastes good. So if you starve someone and you give them a little khichdi and breadsticks, it tastes very, very good. How about you say that? He would say you dress for others and you cook for yourself. Same philosophy. Whatever you cook, he said, you'll think it's good. No matter how much garbage it might taste like, he said, you'll think it's good. So, where was I? I completely lost my train. So yes, we were in Dallas, and Prabhupada says, so anyway, he was explaining these things to me, how he's taking a little rest. So I didn't mind. But rounds, one day in New Dwarka, Prabhupada was sitting behind his desk, and it was the afternoon, and I was cleaning up around his desk. And he's chanting. And Prabhupada in New Dwarka was very nice, because he would sit and he would have his feet straight out. So as soon as you come in the room, you would just see these 2 beautiful lotus feet. You just see these pink undersides of his feet. Prabhupada, such beautiful, beautiful feet Prabhupada had. They were always impeccably clean and always soft, because every day he would massage his whole body with oil, mustard oil, you know, sandalwood oil on his head, and then mustard oil on the rest of the body. His body was very fragrant. Never perspired. Never any bad smells. You can start at his feet. He had very beautiful toes. Again, it was very pink. And he always kept his nails short. He had a typical Indian nail cutter. Just 1 6-inch long thing, right, with a little sharp edge on one side and a little ear tool on the other side. So only a few times I would see him. Sometimes I would go in and I would see him doing his nails with this cutter. Because it looked very dangerous, you know. It was very dangerous to me. We had our clippers, but he used this cutter all the time. So his toenails were always very nice. And of course, his complexion, we see in so many pictures, his complexion was very, very golden complexion. And I would see this. We may as well can talk about this here, because I had that good fortune again of massaging him every day. Anyway, let me finish. In New Dwarka, he had chanting, his feet are sticking out. You say peeking from behind the desk. And I offered obeisances and I sat up and he looked at me. And he was chanting, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram. And he pulled down a counter bead like that. And he said, there, he said, I have finished my 16 rounds. Now I can do any damn thing I want.
Again, these are all instructions for me. Prabhupada was always encouraging you to chant my 16 rounds and read my books. Just one book. Pick a book and read this book. So then, Prabhupada had very nice legs. You know, he was not so tall, short. To us, he was gigantic. But from his feet, which were very beautiful, and he had his legs, you would massage his legs, and just a few little hairs on his legs, his golden colored legs. And then, of course, you always started massage at the top of the head when I massaged Prabhupada with the sandalwood oil, because that's cooling. Prabhupada said, keep a cool head. He said once, for the sannyasis, because back then also sometimes sannyasis were falling down. He says, very dangerous, he said. Material world, a very dangerous place. He said, and for sannyasis, he says, very, very, very dangerous. He said, you know in your country, he said, they have the butter. You know, we sell in our country, and probably here, they have 1 pound of butter. And on the package, it always says at the bottom, store in a cool place. So he said, we should have a big stamp, and we should stamp the foreheads of the sannyasis. Keep in a cool place. He said, no association with woman. Woman, he said, is fire, and man is butter. So butter melts very quickly when it comes in contact with fire. So we would massage Prabhupada's head. Sometimes he would get these headaches. He said, we would give him headaches. Prabhupada, whatever headaches Prabhupada got, we gave him. He got from his disciples big headaches. He would say, he has so many expressions, such sweet and just such clear expressions. This thing he would say, tax my brain, was one of Prabhupada's expressions he would use about us, that we would be taxing his brain. And he would say, don't tax my brain. He said, otherwise how can I do this translating work? And he'd say, it's so difficult work, you know. He did it so carefully. It was his life's work, this translating, right? For the next 10,000 years, it's there for everyone. It's there for all of us, these books. So that's what he would say, don't tax my brain. So the sandalwood is very nice. Prabhupada, of course, had a very nice head. And ears, big ears, long, long earlobes. And you would massage, you would also pull on them, you know, massage. Pull on them a little bit. And they'd rub here. But basically, Prabhupada massage for Srila Prabhupada was a very vigorous rub down. I guess I would say it's kind of like Ayurvedic style massage. It was circulatory massage, you know, to keep the blood flowing. Srila Prabhupada said that three things kept him alive. One was his massage. The other was his morning walk. And Ayurvedic medicine. He took one medicine regularly. It was more of a tonic, Jagendra Ras. It was this Ayurvedic medicine. And he only liked it from one pharmacy here in India that he trusted. He said, because most pharmacies are all bogus, he said. Because this medicine had in it some pearl, ground pearl, and gold was in this medicine. And we always used to have to ship from India, wherever he was, would ship from India that, and you would mix it in, and mortar and pestle. These are one of the things we carried. I had a little mortar and pestle I would carry, and they would ship the black cardamom seed. You could only get it in India. So that was the base, what do they call the vehicle? It was black cardamom seed and a little honey, and then two little balls of Jagendra Ras, you would mix it up. And Prabhupada would take it every other morning with the little hot milk.
And it was very, very, I also look back at that, such a simple thing, every other morning, so you could pick an even day or odd day. Sometimes he would call me and he said, am I supposed to get my medicine this morning? Yes, Prabhupada. Why haven't you brought my medicine? You know, so I couldn't even remember every other day. It was like it was something difficult. But Prabhupada, of course, would remember. So then I would bring him his medicine. So those three things, he said, kept him alive. So and that's why he was very diligent in maintaining his body for Krishna to do his service. He took it very, very seriously wherever he went. He'd never miss a morning walk. Even in Switzerland, in a blizzard, we wound up in St. Moritz, Switzerland for a short trip. It was arranged. It was supposed to be a restful holiday for Srila Prabhupada. It didn't turn out too good. His secretary, we were in India, has shown him this postcard of Switzerland. Beautiful, beautiful card. And there was just miles and miles of flowers, you know, wild flowers in the mountains, green mountains and everything. So Prabhupada went along for this trip for 3 days. The only thing was, we went there in March or April, and it was still like the end of winter in the Swiss Alps. It was in the Swiss Alps. So we got there in the middle of a blizzard, and Prabhupada didn't like the place at all. In fact, we went from Zurich, Switzerland, to St. Moritz. St. Moritz is one of the most, well-known, expensive, high-class ski resorts for the very, very wealthy people that time, still is today. So it was very, very, supposed to be a wonderful place. But Prabhupada wasn't impressed. So we got to Switzerland by plane, and you had to take this train ride to get to St. Moritz because it wound around the Swiss Alps, these mountains. And I remember I was with this one brahmachari, young brahmachari, who was a Pakistani boy, become devotee. And myself and Prabhupada, we went together on the train, and the others were already there. So myself and this brahmachari, we were both brahmacharis, we were very fascinated by the Swiss Alps looking. It was an incredible looking place, these mountains, snow-covered, and we're... Prabhupada's right there at the window. Prabhupada always sat at the window seat on a plane and in a train, wherever it was, he always sat at the window seat. So he's sitting at the window, and I'm right beside Prabhupada, and this boy is right beside me. And we're just talking and enjoying the scene in the countryside and looking at these mountains, snow-covered mountains. And Prabhupada's just chanting, and I guess I had become a little oblivious of Prabhupada being next to me, since I had this boy with me. And so we're talking, and Prabhupada interrupted our nonsense, and he said, what do they call this place we're going? I said, oh, St. Moritz, Prabhupada? St. Moritz. He said, So they may call it St. Moritz. He said, I call it St. Hellish. He said, there's not a living thing to be seen anywhere. He said, this is a horrible place. So immediately we both shut up and said, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Yes, Prabhupada. So the eye is different. Prabhupada had different vision, He had transcendental vision, We were seeing heaven. We thought it was beautiful, This is the materialist idea of beauty, It was sub-zero with snow everywhere. We got there. There was nothing to eat. There was no fruits, no vegetables. And these people were paying, thousands of dollars a day to live in such a place and ski down a mountain. So, but for Prabhupada, it was hell, he said. Not a thing alive here. So we got there in the afternoon, spent the evening. We had a nice, it was like a condominium, with on each side, several of them. But there was a long hallway that went. You get on an elevator, and everything was very, this was in Switzerland. This was 1973 in Switzerland. And at that time, in 73, everything was automatic just by light Like, it's like you wash it, you went to the sink. They have everywhere now, but 1973, I never saw it anywhere but Switzerland. So when you would walk down the hallway, in the elevator door, you push the button, all the lights would go on in the hallway. So when the elevator door would open, the lights would go on in the hallway, and they'd stay on for like 1 minute, which would give you enough time to get to your condominium and get in the door. Otherwise, there were little buttons you could push here and there if you were out too long, or they would go out, the lights just went out. So we got there in the afternoon, spent the day in the evening. So the next morning, Prabhupada got up for his morning walk. It's like 5:30, he got up, he gets all ready, gets me all ready, puts on his coat. He had that pink, the saffron coat. It's made by one Jai Shri in Hawaii. It had this tail with little peacock feathers on the end of it, and a hood. So he had his coat on, and we had our chutters on, and Prabhupada and I, and Prajumna, we're all going to go out on this walk, and we had a sliding glass door that went out to what would have been a yard, but it was all snow, just snow everywhere, snow. And we opened the door, and this big gush of wind came in, and snow just started blowing into the room. And Prabhupada went, "Whoa!" He said, "No, no," he said, "much too cold." He shut the door. And then he said, "That's all right," he said, "we'll walk inside." So myself, so Srila Prabhupada, myself, and it was Prajumna, we started walking up and down the hallway. Prabhupada's got his cane, and it was a long hallway, he was probably just walking back and forth. He had to do his morning walk. I said, Prabhupada was very regulated. The fact that there was 10 feet of snow outside wasn't going to stop him, so he was getting his morning walk, because he was keeping body and soul together. Very important we do what's required to keep body and soul together. So we're walking back and forth, and after about 10 minutes or so walking up and down the hallway, and now remember, these lights are going off unless you push these buttons. So every now and then, as we're walking back and forth, I would push a button on the wall to keep the lights on. Otherwise, it was just complete darkness. We're walking back and forth. So after about 10 minutes, I think Prajumna got a little bored walking up and down this hallway. He said, "Srila Prabhupada, I had some work I have to do, some, you know, from your transcription." He said, "Is it okay if I leave?" "Yes, you can go." So he left. So then Prabhupada's walking. He said, this climate, cold climate, he said, is actually very good for my appetite. He said, I'm feeling hungry. He said, "They have suji here, you can make some halva." I said, "Yes, Prabhupada." He said, "So you can go inside now and make halva." He said, "And I'll keep walking by myself." I said, "All right." So I went inside and started getting the ingredients together, you know, and I'm inside, I'm getting the butter, and I started thinking, these lights are going to go out. So I went, I ran to the door, and I opened up the door, and I see Prabhupada with his cane. Everywhere he goes, "Shh." He's walking, goes to the next spot. So then I called Prajumna and the others. He's talking Prabhupada. Because we would be fast. Anything Prabhupada did in what was like the material world, we found so just incredibly wonderful and sweet. So we just stood there for a few minutes and laughed, watching Prabhupada push these buttons, you know. But immediately Prabhupada just knew just what to do, you know. He just went in and... So he was walking back and forth, pushing. So I went back in and made the halva. But how are we? Is everyone all right? Yeah. Anyone have any questions or comments? Anything you'd like to ask? I'll take a little water here. Yes? No? Yes? No questions? Mataji? Oh. Yes, sorry. That's trouble. Yes. Okay. Hare Krishna. yes, that's what I was going to do next. Yes, okay. I'll tell you in a second. No questions at all? Everything clear? He was saying to talk more about 1972, Srila Prabhupada in Vrindavan. I said, yes, that's what I was going to do next. So he was reading my mind. Okay, yes, so it wasn't long when I became his servant. It was just a few weeks from the time I became his servant till, because it was John Mastami, I became his servant. So then Kartik is just right around the corner, as we say. So, and from that time, Prabhupada was very, very excited about coming to Vrindavan for Kartik. He was really looking forward to it, and he talked about it. It seemed like every time we would get on the plane, because we went from Pittsburgh to Dallas to Los Angeles, San Francisco, then he went to Hawaii, then he went to the Philippines, and then to Delhi. So that was how the trip progressed. And every time he got on the plane, he would start talking, because I guess we'd be on the plane, and he would start talking about being in Radha Damodar Temple for Kartik. He was very eager to get back. And remember, Prabhupada had been there, for, as you say, for some 6 years in Vrindavan. And he loved living in Vrindavan. I mean, he says that. He said in one lecture in Hawaii, he said he had no desire to leave Vrindavan. He was very comfortable there, he said. It was very, very comfortable. He said, but Krishna told him he had to go. And that's when he said he didn't like austerity so much. Krishna said he would make it so there wasn't so many austerities. Prabhupada was very austere, but he said that. But yeah, he was very content. He said to just stay at Radha Damodar Temple. He was doing his writing. He said, in fact, he said that when he got there in 72. He was saying how he would write every day from his spot. Everyone has seen Radha Damodar Temple, I'm sure. Prabhupada's quarters there. Yes, they've all been. In the kitchen where his prasadam was prepared and where he took prasadam, overlooking Rupa Goswami's samadhi. And that's where he did his writing. He said that's where he got his inspiration. And he called it, he called that place the hub of the wheel of the spiritual world. That's what he called his place at Radha Damodar Temple, the very hub of the spiritual world. So the very center, as he said, the spiritual universe, was right there at Radha Damodar. So often on the plains he would talk about, he was going there, and he said, I'm going there for my Western disciples, because that was the first gathering, first big gathering, major gathering in India. It was actually Prabhupada coming back to India, to Radha Damodar, after spreading Krishna consciousness around the world. It was evident Krishna consciousness was going around the world. And now he had come home to that hub, to that very center. And it was like a grand homecoming for Prabhupada. He felt that. Prabhupada would say sometimes, you know, he said so many things. He said that once it was in that garden in New Dwarka, and he was just sitting there chanting, and he sat up very straight and was chanting. He said, Govindam Adi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. He said, I worship Krishna, the primeval Lord. And then he said, the devotee is proud to be servant of Krishna. He said, that is our pride. Everyone has pride. He said, but the devotee's pride is we're a servant of the greatest person, Krishna. That everyone is serving someone. We're serving Krishna. So again, he put out his chest and said again, Govindam Adi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. He said, that's our pride. So that's what I saw when Prabhupada went back, came back here to Vrindavan. This pride in being Krishna's servant and seeing Krishna's fame being spread all around the world, seeing the Maha Mantra travel to every corner of the world. And he was so happy after so much work. 1965. He was talking about all the struggles. Maharaj was saying the difficulties Prabhupada had. He came with nothing. He wasn't being supported by his god brothers in India. No one did anything for Prabhupada. Only Krishna and his spiritual master. Again, that's what he says in the prayers that he wrote, his poetry. As he said, he came here with two things. He came here with complete faith in the chanting of the holy name, and he came with the order of his spiritual master, he said, who was right in his heart. He said, never was with him all the time, he said, his spirit. That's all he had. He didn't have any help from anyone. And then you may hear many stories. You may hear so many things about how people were doing things. No one did anything for Prabhupada back then. Give trouble. But he had that, and that's all he needed. He was confident that with that. He had complete confidence in the chanting of Hare Krishna. And that's what he gave us as he sat there in Tompkins Square Park and he just chanted. Garga Muni was talking the other day to the children at the temple, the Gurukula children, the adult children, teens in their 20s. And he was saying how when they were there with Swamiji back at that time, he never told them to do anything. He never gave them ideas how to help. He just waited for them, for the process to come naturally by the association and by the chanting. He said, and he one day went to Prabhupada and he said, Prabhupada, you know, is there something I can do for you? He said, you're doing all these things. You know, Prabhupada was doing so many things in the early days. You're doing so much. Is there anything I can do? And again, Prabhupada answered him very profoundly, and he said, the duty of the disciple is to assist the spiritual master in his mission. So that's what he told him. So then Garga Muni was 17 years old. He's just a boy. And he was around Prabhupada, and of course, very little was known. They just knew they just loved this amazing, spiritual, revolutionary person. As he described it, we were a bunch of teenagers, and at that time, 1966, you know, 1965, 1966, 1967, in the United States, there was this great movement going on by the youth. You know, the motto was, don't trust anyone over 30. That was the motto, no one over 30, right? You didn't trust. So the youth had no faith in their parents, they had no faith in anything. We were revolutionaries, you know, and no faith in anyone over 30, no faith in the government, no faith in the whole structure within the capitalistic structure of making money to become happy. And this is the atmosphere Prabhupada came in. So the leader of this whole anti-establishment movement for many became Srila Prabhupada, who was what? 70 years old. So he was the oldest person around. It wasn't just over 30, he was 70. But what he gave was so amazing that these young revolutionary people, they were attracted to him. Because he was more revolutionary than they could have imagined, right? They knew they wanted to reject everything, but of course there's the Bhoga Tyag. Their idea was just take intoxication, have illicit sex. That was, you know, that was the way, not get into materialistic society. Instead we'll just have free love and become intoxicated. And we'll experience our spiritual bliss in this way. So Prabhupada was the most revolutionary. He came and exposed them to the possibilities of giving up this whole material world and entering into the spiritual realm. So they became attracted. So Garga Muni asked him, and he said he thought about it for days. What could I do for him? And one day, he was walking down the street and he walked past an electronic shop. And a man was coming outside of this electronic shop with a Grundig dictaphone machine. And Garga Muni, by arrangement of Super Soul or whatever, he asked. And then, anyway, the story, when he bought Prabhupada's first dictaphone machine. Up till that time, Prabhupada was typing on a typewriter with his fingers, two fingers. This is how he was doing the books. So now things started to develop. So anyway, this is how one assists the spiritual master in his mission. This is the duty of the disciple, to assist the spiritual master in his mission. So again, Prabhupada's coming here. I could see how much Prabhupada was looking forward to coming here, because now he wanted to come to India and say, see what these American boys and girls are doing. Because what? Here in India, they were trying to figure out how to become like us in the West, how to become very wealthy, capitalist, materialist. Yeah. They say now India has the largest middle class in the world is in India. Yeah, so many people trying to make money for sense gratification. Making money is okay for Krishna. So anyway, Prabhupada was coming, and this is what he did. Prabhupada, that's what I say, Prabhupada's vision was just so amazing. You know, he went to America, he made devotees, and then brought them back and said, this is what you should be doing. Because they've already tried everything you're attempting now, and they've rejected it. They have, some of them have parents, they're millionaires. They've given it up because there's no happiness there. So this is what Prabhupada brought back. And he brought back to Vrindavan, and he showed everyone there, making these Westerners, turning them into Vaishnavas. I mean, as he said, hippies into happies, he would say. But, and he said to me, and he had it all planned. Again, Prabhupada was in charge. When Prabhupada came to Vrindavan, Srila Prabhupada was in charge. He very much took control of everything because he wanted to make sure that here everything went on properly. He said, otherwise, they have no respect for you in Vrindavan. So he supervised everything. Krishna Balaram, he supervised. He went around on a daily basis on his morning walk. He just chastised and chastised. Criticized. What was his name? Head architect. Surabhi. Oh, he criticized them so much. Chastised them so much. I used to feel so bad for Surabhi. You know, I was chastised. I was with Prabhupada 2.5 years. I was chastised like 4 or 5 times loudly. And that was more than I could deal with, you know. He would get chastised 4 or 5 times in 2 hours. Surabhi, these are so special things. It's so hard, you know. We can never understand Prabhupada's relationship with some of his disciples, you know. I just know Surabhi, whatever he's doing, Prabhupada's going to be grabbing him by his hand and bringing him somewhere, you know. They've done such wonderful things. So, anyway, let's get back to Radha Damodar time. We'll go ahead to Krishna Balaram, 1975. So he said, when we get there, he said, we'll have nectar of devotion classes. This is what he wanted. Srila Rupa Goswami's Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu in Vrindavan during Kartik. It was just amazing. And he said, and you can read? He told me. I just become a servant. I was going to read. Prajumna was always the reader. Bhagavatam class, you always hear Prajumna's voice, right? I was, you know, I couldn't even pronounce the words. And he said, you'll read? And he said, then I'll have you stop and I'll give commentary like that. So I was very excited. I was going to get to read Nectar of Devotion. You know, I thought it sounded nice. And he'd say that every now and then on the plane. Just always couldn't wait to get to Vrindavan. He was so excited about it. So then, of course, we arrived. I think it was just about October 15th that year. The Kartik Brat started. And it was my first trip. It was my first trip to India, to Vrindavan, everywhere. And, of course, when the classes started, Prajumna immediately adopted the service, and I didn't. It was okay with me. There were about 100 devotees, and I was a little shy about reading. But I had my services that I was doing. And I would record. I was recording the classes and massaging and doing other things. I didn't have to cook here. Jamuna was cooking. And as I said, that was, you know, very, very good. You know, excellent. So, Prabhupada would give class. It's just like you hear all these birds. I remember in the evening time, dusk, just around dusk, Prabhupada was speaking at Radha Damodar in the courtyard there, right by the samadhis in the courtyard. And it was just the sweetest thing, you know, and then you would have the little parrots flying in, because that time of the day, you know, all the animals are getting ready. You know, the nocturnal ones are getting ready to go out and create problems. And the daytime, the birds are all coming back to the trees, and you hear the peacocks. And again, this was a completely new experience for myself anyway. And it was just the most sublime atmosphere. And weather like this, very nice in the daytime and cool in the evenings. And Prabhupada spoke in English. It's another thing he said, I'll be speaking in English. He said, because these classes are for my disciples, he said. The Brijvasis may come, he said, and they'll sit. He says, because they'll sit to listen, because the sadhu is there, he said. But I want to speak in English for my disciples. There was no translation in the Hindi, Bengali, just spoke English class, that was it. So we all felt very happy. Prabhupada was there, it was for us, you know, he had come. Everyone had joined there. And again, it was very difficult for many of the devotees. They had to figure out where to stay. There was not guest houses everywhere like there are now. Many stayed at Keshigat Palace. And I don't know, I was with Prabhupada. I always had a room to stay right near him, so I didn't know so much what was going on. But I do know that in at that time in India, you did spend most of your day just taking care of your bodily necessities and trying to keep healthy. It was a big activity, just getting your clothes clean and trying to keep the dysentery from overwhelming you on a regular basis, and the malaria and the jaundice, all things that I found out about in the coming months. But so the birds were there, the monkeys were there. It was all very nice. And Prabhupada was speaking. So Prajumna would read. So I was sitting just like this devotee here. I was sitting right there with, we had an Ur. It's called an Ur, German tape, reel-to-reel tape recorder. We have a very limited amount of tape back then. And Prabhupada left for a month or two. That's why you'll see over the years the amount of conversations increases, because early on there was only so much tape that you were given. And when Prabhupada came to India, there was no question of, cassette player didn't even exist. So many things weren't recorded. But, so I was recording just like this, and sitting there, and I was fanning Prabhupada. Because the one thing that were there, the peacocks were there, lovebirds were there, monkeys were there, but flies were also there. Right? So you used to have to try. We had a chamara fan, you know. So, anyway, the one day, and this was in the evening, and I was also very happy now. I was in Vrindavan. It was just a wonderful environment. And I was feeling very happy now being Prabhupada's servant. And I also comfortable. I've been a servant now for some weeks. And also feeling a little pride. Different kind of pride, the wrong kind of pride. I was Prabhupada's servant, you know, and I was all my God brothers and God sisters. So I'm fanning Prabhupada. And Prabhupada's speaking, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And I have a chamara fan. So again, I told you I was pujari, so I was fanning Prabhupada like a pujari. I really wasn't noticing the flies buzzing around. I'm just doing this nice, you know, twirling this fan. And Prabhupada's speaking, and he's like this. And he's going every now and then. He's going like this because flies are going. And I'm still like this. So finally, and sound system is there. You know, they got a big sound system. And everyone's there. So Prabhupada goes, and he looked at me, and he goes, get someone up here with some intelligence. So I went from the top of the universe there, and I was like this big. So this brahmachari comes up, and he was known. This brahmachari had come from England. He was this big guy with these big, thick glasses, black glasses, and he was known as being what we would call eccentric, right? You know, eccentric. When somebody has lots of money and they're crazy, they call them eccentric. If you're poor, they just say you're crazy. That's the difference. If you're wealthy, it's, you know, when people have money, everything is okay. So anyway, he was known as being rather eccentric devotee. So he pulled the chamara out of my fan, out of my hand. So then I went right and sat down. I had this tape recorder. I had lots of dials, so I was making believe I was doing things with the dials because I just couldn't cope with, you know, with Prabhupada chastising me in front of everyone in Vrindavan. So I was trying to do some service, although I didn't have anything to do. So then this boy gets the fan, and he's like this. He's like 6'5". He's going like that. And I'm standing, and I'm looking at him, and I'm thinking, you know, what's Prabhupada going to think about that? And Prabhupada's speaking, and the boy's fanning, and then Prabhupada stopped, and he looked at him, and he said, "Very good." So then I went, shh, look at that dude. I became very, very humble all of a sudden. I was not very arguing, so humble. So then I just sat there still. I didn't lift my head the rest of it. I just sat there with my head down. And I felt so terrible. This was my first really big chastisement Prabhupada had done. And then I remember after it was over, we all back to Radha Damodar temple, and we all walked back into the in front of the temple there, the courtyard there. And Prabhupada went into his quarters. And this one brahmachari came up to me that knew me, and he said, "Oh, Prabhu, you're so fortunate to get chastised like that by Srila Prabhupada." I just looked at him. And I thought, yeah, let him chastise you like that. See how you like it. Of course, now it's a fact. I see back there, to me now, is one of my most fond memories is Prabhupada chastising me like that. You know, and I just wish you were here to daily chastise me like that. You know, see? That's the time factor. The time factor. Prabhupada used to talk about that so much. Just like we're spending so much time here now, yes? We're here for a month. We're here for many hours. Prabhupada would sometimes, he would give classes, and he would get it with his watch, you know? It's just like now. It's 12:10. Right? In 5 seconds, he'd be on the Vyasasana. I remember in New Dwarka. I remember in the manor. He would do like that, you know?